Warning, this episode contains a giant green penis. You are tuned to Radio Free Asgard, episode number 58, the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois. Welcome to the show. Before we get started this week, I just want to do a very quick shout out here to Scott, who is now listening to the show. Hello, Scott. Now, Scott does his own podcast, which is called the Uncommon Sense Podcast, because common sense there is uncommon, something like that. I don't remember what the buzz line. Just kidding, Scott. Scott has kind of followed me over here as the result of other projects that I've worked on, such as Tom Harris USA, etc., and he was curious to hear what I was up to lately. This show, basically, is what I've been up to lately, so it's very nice to have you along, Scott, and I hope you're enjoying the dramatizations, as it were, of these various old Thor comics, and if you enjoy it, stick around. Anyway, you can go hear Scott's podcast over at podteacher.com. And it does sort of a general purpose podcast. We also got a very brief mention this past week on the Chicago Geocacher podcast. Walt and Scott are great guys, and they've been plugging the show. Both of them are big old comic book nerds, though they usually forget to give the URL. So what do you do? It's great that they're thinking of me anyway. All right, so I had a lot of news or anything like that. It's been a slow week. We do have a couple of issues to cover, so let's just get on with it, shall we? And here we go to our reviews.
Cross the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar. You'll behold in breathless wonder.
So we're going to start out this week with wrapping up of Baldur the Brave limited series with issue number 4. Thank goodness about that. I hate to say that about a Walt Simonson project, because I tell you something, folks. I have utmost respect for Walt Simonson as a person, as an artist, as a writer. Most of the stuff that he does, I absolutely love. And it kind of bothers me a little bit that I'm not enjoying this Baldur the Brave miniseries more than I am. But we're going to stick through it. We're going to get to the end of it, and we'll see if maybe it manages to redeem itself in the last issue. Well, the cover is certainly encouraging. It's a beautiful Walt Simonson cover here, and it shows Baldur dressed as Sunboy. And no, I only wish I was kidding there. He's wearing the yellow diaper and the red tights, just like Sunboy, though I'm sure that that's not intentional. And he's holding up his arms, and it looks like he's glowing or radiating heat or whatever. And there's these pale blue frost giants, and they're cowering before him, and they're covering their face. And the cover blurb says, Sunrise. Really great cover, I have to say. And we open up to the splash page, and the title of the story here is called Baldur the Beautiful, and is written by Walter Simonson, drawn by Sal Buscema, lettered by John Workman, colored by Paul Becton, editor is Ralph Macchio, and the editor-in-chief, as always, is Jim Shooter. Incidentally, this was published in May of 1986 and retailed for 75 cents. And the splash page shows Baldur in the arena where we saw him at the end of the last issue. Remember, he just took out Hagen, who is the greatest swordsman among the giants of Jotunheim. And it shows him throwing the sword of Frey up towards the window. As you remember, Agnar is up in the window. Remember, he kind of appeared at the end of the last issue there. And Baldur shouting, Agnar! And he's throwing him the sword, which of course we know is the magical sword of Frey, one of the greatest weapons of the gods. And on the next page, we see Agnar catches the sword, and he's thinking to himself, Baldur hath surrendered his blade without a word. Well, That's not true. He shouted Agnar. I guess, does that not count as a word? I guess it counts as a name. Anyway, Agnar's thinking he's defenseless. What means this riddle? And the giants have noticed Agnar there, and Utgard-Loki is like, hold, scum! Throw down that sword and descend from thy lofty perch, else I shall slay the Norn Queen, whose life I hold in my very hands. And Agnar says, spoken like a true frost giant, Utgard-Loki, ever courageous in the face of overwhelming odds. But the life of Carnilla means nothing to Agnar of Vanaheim. Farewell, Baldur, my thanks for the gift. And he goes jumping out the window, and the giants are like, kill him, brothers! And they throw their axes at the window. You see the window basically being smashed by all these axes flying through the window. But Agnar is jumped off of the ledge. Is it just me, or was that really a long way up? In that case, it would be really a long way down as well. And all the giants are saying, slay the queen! Death to Carnilla! And they're stopped by Utgard-Loki. He says, hold, my subjects. Let not your wrath overwhelm your reason. All the ways of Jotunheim are ours. And how shall such a little god escape the magic blade or know? As for the lady, she is still our hostage against Baldur. Bind him well and take him to the deepest dungeons. And they tie up Baldur in what looks like string. And Utgard-Loki reminds Baldur that he's holding Carnilla's life against his good behavior. And then he summons Blok, which is very odd because we have Sunboy and Blok. So you have two members of the Legion of Superheroes present. And you can even argue that Blok is sort of giant-ish, though. He's not a frost giant, though, so I guess that wouldn't matter. So anyway, yeah. So this is the most Legion-y issue of Thor or Thor-related product ever. So Blok shows up and he looks like, he looks a little bit like, well, to be honest, he looks like an E.C. Seagar character. Not really like Bluto or Brutus, but he has this, that kind of E.C. Seagar look to him, which is kind of odd. It's kind of like Bluto, but without the beard, if you know what I mean. And he's wearing a headband. So, you know, again, another Legion reference, I guess. And Utgard-Loki says, Agnar has shown the measure of these gods, Blok. I doubt that even for a hostage like Baldur will they surrender their kingdom, and I deem Baldur too dangerous a prisoner to hold in any case. Now, while he still thinks we wish to keep him alive, is the time to strike. Take two others and slay the Shining One, quickly! You giants, take your weapons and seek out this Agnar, but carefully. Do not seek to kill him, for the Blade of Fry will guard him against any attack. Merely find him and keep him at bay with pikes and spears. The cold will do the rest. And again, a up-close shot of Utgard-Loki looking really mean. He's like, for from my tower I will work my magic upon the realm. No road will lead him anywhere but back to this castle. No tree will give him shelter. And bitter shall it be this night in Jotunheim. And we then cut to Agnar running across the landscape through, you know, frozen trees and spiky rocks and stuff. And, it's a little bit better transition than what we've had before. He thinks to himself, methinks the wind grows colder by the second. Odin grant that I have read Baldur's riddle rightly. For when he threw the Blade of Fry to me, he also passed the torch. Surely Utgard-Loki would have slain Carnilla had Baldur tried to escape. And Baldur could not abandon the woman he loves to certain death. But how can I now abandon him? Yet Asgard must be warned that the Frost Giants are planning to attack the Golden Realm now that Odin is gone. But whatever the cost, Baldur has chosen me to carry the warning. I shall not fail him. But where was our camp? Only there shall I find supplies that will enable me to reach Asgard, and I can barely see my hand before my face. And then he sees a little bit of a trail here. Here runs some track through these icy wastes. It seems to be leading me in the direction I wish to go. Up there, those shadows. Have I found the forest of dead trees that hides our camp? Or... And we don't find out what he sees because we cut back to the palace. We then cut to the workshop of Utgard-Loki, and he's decided to put Carnilla in a bottle for safekeeping. So she's still chained up and, you know, with her arms above her head, but now it's like stuck in a stopper and she's in a bottle now. Utgard-Loki is performing various incantations and spells to keep Agnar from getting away, basically. He explains that, you know, Agnar has a long way to go between the borders of Jotunheim and the Norn realm, and the giants in their world are as one, being bound together by the bonds of ice and hatred. And he's called upon the night to grow colder, but now he commands it using his green glowy magic. And he says, soon it shall be so icy that a warm-blooded creature will perish, while the frost giants only grow stronger. Yeah, I guess that would be handy about being a frost giant. I dare say that even Baldur in his cell below will feel the sting of the cold for all his vaunted warmth. Agnar's frozen body shall be found beside the sword of Fry. And there's cast a spell with a giant Serac and a big green glowing explosion. We then cut back to Agnar wandering around the wastes of Utgard-Loki's kingdom, and he realizes that he's walking in circles. The trail is leading him back to the castle, and he realizes that the trails are obviously illusions. But just then, he happens to notice the king of the eagles, Whiteface, who had guided him here in it was last issue, I think. And he's wondering if the eagle is an illusion too, but he doesn't think that the giants would think of that. Because I don't know if the giants actually knew that the eagle had led him there to begin with. So he decides he's going to follow the eagle and does that. And then we cut back to the dungeon. And the frost giants are pitching Baldur down the stairs. And he goes thump, thump, thump down the stairs and lands with a kunk. And they're laughing and they're saying, "Here's your room, shrimp. Har, har, har. Maybe we'll send down a blanket if we don't forget. Har, har, har." And they slam the door and the door goes slam. And Baldur's thinking that his hands are so cold he can hardly move, but yet he doesn't think that the giants are going to remember to bring a blanket. But he does hear footsteps approaching his cell, but he notices that the footsteps are coming from the wrong direction. And they're giants, and they're coming, I guess, to kill him. And it's like, "Won't Baldur's head look good hanging from the top of the keep?" And they're like, "Shh, quiet, we don't want to give him a warning. Get ready," and they come bursting through the door, saying, "Slay the scum! Death to the enemies of Jotunheim!" And they have a reaction shot here. Huh? And they notice that Baldur is gone, and he has melted a hole through the wall. So I guess sometimes the castle is made of ice, and sometimes it's made of stone. At least it's not very consistent. But anyway, Baldur has melted a hole through the wall and has made his escape. And they go running back upstairs, like, "Oh, the chief isn't going to like this."
"Gee, Yogi, I don't think the ranger's going to like this."
Utgard-Loki is still working in his little laboratory, and he's saying, "So you see, Carnilla, the merest addition of shredded ram's bladder completes the universal solvent." Yeah, that's a Monty Python reference there. I should say in another century or two. And they come bursting in, and, "Please, my lord, spare your servant. I bring terrible news." "How now?" And at the moment, Baldur comes bursting in through the wooden door with a shatter. It's like he's using super strength. It doesn't look like he's actually using heat. And Utgard-Loki is holding this jar of viscous pink liquid above his head. And "Then the time has come for us to be rid of this tiny pest once and for all." And he throws the jar down. The giant Kirash, and this pink stuff goes splashing everywhere. But Baldur manages to dodge it, apparently. And he's like, "Well thrown, good Utgard, but thy reflexes are not a match for thy intentions, and you'll not have a second chance." And Baldur picks up a chair and hurls it at the giants and kind of hurls the chair past Utgard-Loki and starts smashing all these jars and things. And the stuff inside the jars are splashing out over the frost giants, and the giants are going, "Arg, my face! Look out, the chemicals have sparked a blazing fire!" And Utgard-Loki is panicking. He says, "Where's that Asgardian scum? I'll have him flayed alive for this." And he jumps on top of a jar that has a seal rubber banded to the top, and it acts like a trampoline. And he is able to launch himself off of this to reach the table where Carnilla is being held in the jar. And he smashes the jar using his super strength, which I don't remember him really having super strength before, but I guess we can just kind of blame this on the magic. I'm just going to accept it for now. I mean, Baldur is strong in the same way that all the Asgardians are stronger than normal people, but at the same time, he's not Thor strong, and he shouldn't be able to do things like smash in doors and lift giant chairs and stuff like that unaided. But again, he also now has this new energy surge power, whatever, and so maybe that gives him super strength. I don't know. Anyway, he jumps up on the table and he smashes the jar, and he warns Carnilla to turn away, but it still seems to me that smashing a jar with somebody inside it from the outside would still run the risk of slicing her up with broken glass. But apparently he gets very lucky and that doesn't happen. And then he notices Utgard-Loki. He's dipping his hand into this pouch that he carries. Remember the dust that he turned everything to stone with? Well, that's what's in the pouch. And Baldur is saying, "What now, Utgard-Loki?" "The flames have been extinguished, godling, and your time has run out. You and Carnilla shall share the fate of her entire kingdom. Perhaps you should embrace and enjoy each other's caresses eternally. For the doubly dust of Utgard Loki shall turn you to stone forever. And he hurls a wad of this powder. And it doesn't act like a normal powder that would just kind of spread out and go foof, you know. Try throwing some flour at somebody that's not wet. And you'll see how this should act. But actually, it just kind of is like a little wad of powder. Like a little powder ball. Baldur is thinking he has but one chance. If he can ignite the powder before it hits him, then he may avoid the terrible doom. And he glows glowing yellow like Sun Boy and ignites the powder with a giant shkaroom. And Utgard Loki looks very alarmed here. He says, "My dust! Baldur's burning rays are causing it to explode. And the heat within the tower bids fair to become unbearable." Apparently they don't have much of a tolerance for heat here. They're kind of like me in that way. And Baldur's glowing really, really bright and really, really hot as the Johnny Storm's Nova Burst or Sun Boy's powers or whatever. Anyway, Baldur's like, "The trick worked. Cardoa and I are still flesh and blood, but I must radiate all the energy I can, lest any of the dust remain." And so he's trying to consume all of this magical dust by burning it all up. But of course, he's also burning up the giants. And also, because this castle seems to be made half of rock and half of ice, people are kind of panicky about that. And the giants are like, "Baldur, forbear! The heat is more than we can stand! Mercy!" And Baldur's like, "Surely my eyes deceive themselves, for even as I grow hotter and hotter, the room around me seems to shrink. Nay, I see it clearly now. This whole palace is a giant shrinky-dink." Because you can't really explain this any other way, folks. The palace and the giants are shrinking. They're not melting. They're shrinking. So obviously the palace is made. It's a giant shrinky-dink. And for those of you who don't remember what shrinky-dinks are, I guess I'm going to have to explain that to you. And there's these sheets of plastic, and they would have pictures on them, or you would draw pictures on them with a special, like, crayons, pens. I don't remember exactly what it was you drew on them with. And then you would take these, and you would cut out the shapes you want to be, and then you put it in the oven on, like, a cookie sheet, and it would melt the plastic, and it would keep the shape and the drawings intact, but it would shrink them down, and they'd get really thick. And that's what a shrinky-dink was. Anyway. Very fun, very safe activity for unattended children with a gas stove. I don't think they make those things anymore. You'd think that'd be a little bit too dangerous for kids to be playing with an oven like that now. Anyway, so apparently, yes, these people are shrinky-dinks. And Baldur says, "The room, this very castle itself is melting." And Utgard Loki is like, "Gag!" "And the giants, too. They are like the land itself. Creatures of sleety blood and frozen hate. They cannot stand the sun so close." And Baldur seems to be growing larger, but in fact it's the whole castle and the giants are growing smaller, and now he's much, much larger than they are, and he's reaching down for them as they try to run away, and he's like, "No, my brave little giants, the shoe is on the other foot." It's interesting that the table apparently shrank a whole lot as well, but the table's clearly made out of wood, and the bottles have also shrunk, and they are clearly made out of glass. So this is inconsistent in the artwork. So Baldur picks up Utgard Loki by his cape, and he's like, "Fear not, Utgard Loki. My hand is cooled, and Baldur shall not harm thee. Though in sooth there are those who will upbraid me for not melting you all into water when I had the chance. But such is no longer Baldur's way. Begone," and he throws Utgard Loki aside. He says to Utgard Loki, "Do not forget this lesson. Should the frost giants overreach themselves, Baldur shall once again bring the sun to Jotunheim. Now, my lady, let us undo these demeaning shackles." And she's going, And apparently, I don't know if he's melting the shackles or he just has the ability to just unlock them because they were... It looks like they're buckled on, but you'd think Carnilla herself would have been able to unbuckle them. Anyway, so he takes off the shackles and the gag off of Carnilla, and she's like, "Free at last! Run, Utgard Loki! Run, you cur! And no matter how far you go, nowhere shall be far enough that I shall not find you and make you pay for the indignities I've suffered." And Baldur's kind of trying to appeal to her better nature. "The Carnilla, please, my love, let them go. Is this what Baldur wishes? That the enemies who stole Carnilla and laid waste her kingdom should go free? The giant's castle has been destroyed. They themselves have been so reduced in size that they have been rendered harmless. Would we still seek their lives? Come, And he and Carnoa mount up. Apparently there's horses there in the castle. And apparently the horses aren't shrinkydinks. Oh, actually, maybe they were, because they could have been, like, giant horses, I suppose. I mean, why would the giants keep normal-sized horses around? So maybe they are shrinkydinks. Doesn't look like the same horses they came on, but it could be, I suppose. Apparently there are furs in there, too, and they're wearing furs now. It says, "These borrowed furs shall warm us till we reach Norn Realm. Thoughts of Utgard Loki running free shall keep me burning." Is our only choice, then, to become like the frost giants, living in hate and destroying everything we cannot love? If I thought, O queen, that you were no more than a frost giant in a beautiful disguise, I should not love you. And she is like, Baldur, what's that? Trying to change the subject. And they happen across the body of Ratusk. Remember him? It was the Pokemon who got smashed while wearing Baldur's cloak and helmet. She's basically, oh, 'tis Ratusk, the very demon that is... the demon whom you did bid me spare when we first left my kingdom. And she's leaving out the part where she actually sent him out to die in the cold. Baldur's like, "Your faith in him was rewarded, as you deserved, lady. Alone of all his fellows, he avoided the deadly dust of stone and followed the giants who kidnapped you back to their lair." And she's wondering why he was wearing Baldur's armor. And he's leaving out the fact that he tricked him into wearing it because he knew that he was going to get smashed. But he's like, "He wore it to lay a false trail for the giants, enabling me to enter the great fortress. The giants slew him. He died as he lived." So they kind of both lying to each other, which is not really a great basis for a relationship, if you ask me. And so she's saying, "I'm too tired to take us home with magic, Baldur, but your armor I can repair. Please, for my sake, do not leave poor Ratusk for the savage beasts." So they bury him. And underneath a mound of rocks or ice or whatever they have here in this kingdom. And they finish. He's wearing his armor. It's all fixed again. And then we cut back to where Agnar is. And he's finally managed to follow the eagle back to Carnilla's castle. In doing so, he's exhausted his food and his water. But he's hoping that there's still some supplies here left in the castle of Carnilla. He goes to the guardhouse, which it seems undisturbed. And he's hoping that there'll be somebody there. But he sees a shadow, and he's thinking it's some evildoer. And he's like, "Stand, villain! I ride for Asgard, and nothing shall prevent me from reaching my appointed goal." And it turns out to be Hogan the Grim. And he says, "So it should seem, Agnar of Vanaheim, least of all me. When last we met, warrior, you were a callow youth. Now I perceive a marked change in thine eyes, and I recognize the fabled blade you bear." Well, how could they? I mean, hasn't it been in Carnilla's kingdom for like thousands of years? But I guess it doesn't look that different from any other sword that Salbisema draws, so I'm kind of wondering how they can tell it apart. Anyway, he gives Agnar a supply pouch sort of thing and offers to take care of his horse. And Agnar's eating, and he's, I guess, telling his story. And Hogan says, "'Tis said the blade of Fry will not tolerate the unjust, but that has ever proven to be their bane. No matter, I think it will permit you to wield it should the need arise. Now tell me of Baldur." And he's kind of filling him in, and he doesn't know whether Baldur is alive or dead, but, you know, he trusted him to carry the word to Asgard and said, you know, he's not intending to fail him. And then he wonders why Hogan is here looking for Baldur. And then Hogan is saying, "The great Allthing has met in Asgard, and Baldur hath been declared the new lord of the Golden Realm." And Agnar's like, "What? Baldur, king?" "Aye, and I come to bring him home. Now we must make haste to Asgard, but I shall leave my message behind, for Baldur is a valiant and noble warrior." Now, doesn't seem odd? They don't know whether Baldur is alive or dead. He's been declared king, but they're not going to wait around and see if he shows up or go looking for him? Oh, we'll just leave this note, and if he happens to survive, then he'll find it. Herpy derpy derp. It really doesn't make any sense to me. And he's basically just kind of dismisses all the concern and saying, "If any can win through the giants of Jotunheim, 'twill be he. By this blade, he will know that Hogan hath been here." And so, yeah, Hogan's leaving his knife behind. And so then Hogan and Agnar both go riding off towards Asgard. And we cut back to the cave, or a cave, where Baldur and Carnoa are resting. And, they're just kind of making chit-chat. Baldur's saying, "You're quiet tonight, my love. Do you still dream of Utgard Loki and his destruction? I still wonder what kind of love for me you bear that holds your hand from striking at my enemies. Have you not considered, Carnilla, that sometimes there's more cruelty and kindness?" "What do you mean?" Perhaps it will all be the more painful for Utgard-Loki and his minions to live thus, in bodies that will match their pettiness of spirit, dwelling upon the bitter memories of this defeat. They will not be martyrs to an evil cause. They will be laughingstocks, and he and his minions shall serve as living examples to frost giants everywhere not to set themselves against the will of the gods. And Carnoa points out, quite rightly, I sometimes wonder, Baldur, which of us is the crueler? It says, do you? Then consider Ratusk and his sacrifice. Would he have done the same for you if you had punished him for attacking me? Perhaps there are better ways to rule than through fear. I will always remember my demon, Baldur. Never before had I seen one of that breed perform an act out of loyalty. Perhaps you are right, and love is a greater weapon than fear.
Perhaps love is not a weapon.
In any case, I have no kingdom left to rule. I am a queen without a country.
Yet you are a sorceress as well, one of great ability and renown. Your subjects still exist, the victims of a terrible magic. But are they not still your subjects?
Right here I would love for Carnoa to say something like, well, basically no, they're basically just garden gnomes now.
And as they owe their allegiance to their queen, does not their queen owe her allegiance to them? The responsibilities of that high office are not lightly brushed aside. Perhaps it is within your power to restore them to life.
I do not know, Baldur. I watched Utgard-Loki carefully and know much more than formerly of giant magic. And this much I have learned. The enchantments of the giants are very different from my own. But you are right. I shall attempt it, and perhaps someday I shall succeed. And you?
Never fear, my queen. Baldur shall stay by your side. I have not journeyed all the way into Jotunheim to cast aside the prize and return to my silent hall in Asgard.
And we then cut to Baldur and Carnoa arriving at the gates of Norn Realm. And the gates kind of look cool. I actually like the way they look. Kind of like, I don't know, like giant, very stylized lion heads, I guess you could say. And so they're going in, and she's like, the gates of Norn Realm at last. It seems an age since I was carried through them by the giants of Utgard-Loki. I hardly feel like the same woman.
Well, she was a bird for a while. Maybe that explains it. I too feel changed. And there ahead is Norn Keep, as quiet and as empty as the day Agnar and I arrived and found it lifeless. Yet your people are all here awaiting your return. And they're made of stone, so they've been waiting around.
Their waiting will be over someday, I swear it.
I do not doubt it, Carnilla.
And he's calling for Agnar to see if he's here and saying, yo, Agnar, you here? And he doesn't get the answer, so they're wondering if he got killed by the giants. But they didn't find his body on the way home because, you know, that, of course, is a huge kingdom and it could be anywhere. Then Carnilla notices a knife pinning something to the door of the guardhouse, and she goes over to check it out and makes an excuse. Says, my lord, if you would see to the horses, I would prepare a small repast to refresh our spirits. We are both tired, I think. And she goes and looks at the note and notices that it's addressed to Baldur. And she's reading it while he has his back turned, and he's talking to the horses. And yeah, I guess he's friends with horses like he is with birds. Maybe he speaks horse. I'd like to hear that. Anyway.
Unbelievable. Baldur hath been chosen ruler of Asgard, and this note bids him to return to the Golden Realm at once. No, I'll not stand for it. After all that has happened, surely he and I deserve an hour of peace. Thor, thou blusterer, I shall never forgive thee for not taking thy rightful throne.
And he comes back from having stabled the horses. She changes her mind about keeping it from him and hands him the note. And he's like, for me, I recognize the dagger. It belongs to Hogun. And he reads the note and realizes that he is now the king of Asgard. And she points out that she actually quotes Baldur here.
And as they owe their allegiance to their queen, does not their queen owe her allegiance to them?
That is true of kings as well, is it not, Baldur?
And what can you say, my love? You are trapped by your words as I.
And she basically is like, yeah, okay, well, I'm going to go. It's okay if you leave, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, Carnilla,
do not shatter my faith. Do not ask me to return to Asgard. Is my place not here? Once, a lifetime ago, I withheld something that would have been a help to you, and so the giants found the sword of Freyr in my armory. It is my gift to you now.
Well, it's not like she has a choice. It's not here anymore.
Had I been less selfish earlier, our fates might have been different. Odin himself might still rule Asgard, and I would not be losing you. I'm sure Agnar keeps it in trust for you even now. Someday, it may bring you safely back to me. Take my ring, too, that Baldur might remember his Carnilla, and know that wherever he is, her thoughts are with him. Now go, my love, before I forget that I am a queen, and not a woman. And the two of them go smooch, and And we then see Balder on his horse riding forlornly off. And Carnilla is kind of wrapped in the kind of fur, and she's wearing her purple She-Hulk dress. And Balder the Brave goes riding off into the sunset. And so that is the end. I guess. And we actually, it's not quite the end. They have a beautiful, actually, double-page spread at the end of the issue by Walt Simonson. It looks like Simonson inking Buscema, because the characters very definitely look like Buscema. And it makes me wish that Simonson had inked this whole miniseries. It looks so much better than Buscema inking himself. It looks like he redrew some of the faces a little bit. You know, Agnar actually looks like reasonably intelligent. And it shows Balder, and he's standing in his armor, and he's holding up the sword of Frey, and it's glowing. And we have Carnilla in a different outfit standing next to him. On the other side of him is Agnar. And behind him are the giants, including Hagen and Utgard Loki. And in the foreground, we have some of Carnilla's demon guards. And standing behind Carnilla, we have Hag. And we even have the eagle up there in the corner. So that is Balder the Brave number 4. Okay, so I'm going to say something that I've been kind of making fun of the series and talking about that, how it is kind of a disappointment. I'm not going to go back on that entirely because it is a little bit disappointing. I remember being disappointed by it in 1986, and I'm still kind of disappointed in it now. Now, I will readily admit that most of the reason why I'm disappointed in this is because of the artwork. To me, it just isn't up to the story. Not that the story is Simonson's best work either. The whole project to me reads as though Jim Shooter went to Ralph Macchio and said, hey, you know, since Simonson took over Thor, that book is really popular now. It's doing really well. We ought to see if we can spin somebody off from it. Well, who are we going to spin off from Thor? I know, let's spin off Balder. But wait, didn't Balder get all fat and depressed? Besides, Balder doesn't have any interesting powers at all. Well, I know, we'll give him new powers, and we'll give him a magic sword, and we'll make him skinny again. And, yeah, we'll get Simonson to write it, but, you know, he doesn't have time to draw it, too. So who are we going to get? And they go to one of Marvel's old, reliable, tier 2 artists. I mean, that's kind of how this reads to me, is that, you know, they're trying to capitalize on the popularity of Simonson's Thor. Now, that being said, I do think, to some extent, the fourth issue wraps up the series in a satisfying way. We do get a little bit more of the character development of Carnilla, though it all kind of happened in this last issue. It seems as though like a major change. Of course, she was a bird for half this thing, so you really can't blame for that. But you really do have now a little bit more depth to this Carnilla character. Now, as we go forward into the Lee Kirby stuff, because we're going to be doing that, of course, too, we're going to be getting to some of Carnilla's really early appearances soon. So we can see what a contrast this is. I think that the people remember Carnilla more as a sort of amoral, almost evil individual. If you remember when I was talking about the Executioner and the Enchantress and how they were redeemed during the Simonson run, and you know, they became less of a villain. I think Carnilla is going through the same process here. There's still a lot of things about it I don't like. There's still a lot of inconsistency about, you know, is the castle stone? Is it ice? Is it both? Is it neither? You know, and there are a lot of things about it that I didn't care for. And then you have this whole idea of Balder as the Shining One. You know, yeah, sure, that came out of mythology. That's not something that Lee and Kirby had established back in the day. But nowadays, and even in 1985, that seems really derivative. I mean, he's almost like Sunboy, like I said, the Legion of Superheroes, or the Human Torch. And the powers that he has possessed here, they're not really all that remarkable. And it's almost as though Simonson realizes that this is derivative, because on top of these sort of Sunboyish powers, he drops in this giant called Block. Is that his way of kind of teasing us? That it's like, yeah, I know this is lame. Yeah, I know this is just like Sunboy, and so I'm going to have a giant named Block in there. You know, I know that Simonson is a Legion fan, so it's not completely outside of the realm of possibility. It really kind of makes me wonder. Especially since Block had been around as a character in the Legion for a good long while before this miniseries came out. It is enough to make me wonder, does Simonson kind of feel the same way about this miniseries as I do? Maybe did he think of it as kind of a throwaway story?
Maybe he didn't think of it as being his best work. Maybe he didn't want to do the series at all. Maybe Shooter said, well, either you write it, Walter, or we're going to get Ron Frenz to write it. You know, I don't know. It does make me wonder. But by and large, I'm going to say this is just merely mediocre. You know, it's not horrible. It's not great. But it's not something that I would want to buy a whole series of. And I would expect a little bit more, maybe, of something like this. I mean, now he's Light Ray of the New Gods, except he can't fly. So I don't know. Anyway, so that's sort of my general dissatisfaction with the series. But I think you kind of knew that I was already kind of dissatisfied with it. Now, if there are people out there who disagree with me, if you think that I'm completely off base, if you think this is the greatest series since sliced bread, let me know. The email address for the show is radiofreeasgard@gmail.com, or you can contact us on the Facebook and join the Radio Free Asgard Facebook group. I do love hearing from people, and I do love feedback, so let us know what you think. Okay, so moving right along, let's go back in time, back to September of 1967, and Thor number 144, which retailed for 12 cents. And we start out this issue right with a giant green penis. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Very blatantly on the cover, standing erect on the cover of Thor number 144. And we don't see who's holding the giant green penis, but I suppose it really doesn't matter. And Thor is in the background, and guess where he is? He's in the middle of the street, of course. And guess who's behind him in the middle of the street? A whole big crowd of people, because apparently in New York City there are no cars, and everyone just hangs around in the middle of the street all day, at least in the Marvel Universe. Anyway, so Thor is whirling his hammer about and going towards the giant green penis with his hand like he's going to grab it, which is just strangely arousing. Anyway, so he's shouting, "For Asgard!" And the cover blurb says, "The one you've been waiting for." Oh, I bet it is. "This battleground, Earth." And we open up to the splash page where we have a full page, splash page, obviously, of Thor and Baldur and the Lady Sif. And we're kind of picking up where we left off, and there's a brief recap here. And it says, two of the three evil enchanters have landed upon our mortal planet to destroy the mighty Thor, whilst the third has dared enter Asgard to challenge the reign of Odin himself. But Baldur the Brave and Stunning Sif have managed to reach first, bringing him a warning. And that's a very good, very concise summary of what happened last issue. And we have the credits of the story, written and drawn by Stan the Man Lee and Jack King Kirby, embellishing by Vinnie Coletta, back from vacation apparently, and lettered by Sam Rosen. And they are talking amongst themselves about the enchanters having arrived on Earth, and they're doing a little bit of exposition as Stan Lee was wont to do, and Baldur saying, "The enchanters are brothers three, who do possess the magic living talisman. Long have their names been breathed in fearful whispers by the youth of Asgard." "The enchanters," says Thor, "from the mystic realm of the dreaded Ringsfjord, where they make great wine, apparently. It has long been prophesied that they would one day strike at the very core of life itself, where Asgard doth hold reign." "Their might is most awesome to behold, my lord. We were powerless to stop them. Indeed, we did barely escape with our very lives to warn thee." And, Thor's like, "Okay, yeah, good going, guys, because you made it to me and warned me anyway, so now we can be on guard." And then they notice this green glowing light right outside Dr. Don Blake's office window. So apparently the living talisman knows Thor's secret identity, or maybe it can follow the trail of free-flowing electrons that the gods leave behind them, which is one of the sillier things from Journey into Mystery. Anyway, so this green glowing thing outside the window, and Thor's like, "They have found us! Now stand ye ready, the time for battle hath dawned. No matter their power, no matter their weaponry, they shall learn how Asgardians do fight." And the light forms itself into the face, and it's the same face that's on the chest of all of these enchanters, but it's a glowing green version of it. Very Wizard of Oz-ish here, saying, "None can hide from the power of the enchanters. The warriors of Asgard hide not, accursed one. Where thy masters appear, here do we stand. Thou speakest with the tongue of a fool. Thy weapons are merely strength and courage, which the enchanters do possess in equal measure.
plus the matchless power of sorcery supreme. And Thor's not taking any of that. He hurls his hammer at the glowing glob of light. Says, let this be thine answer, brazen one. Thou speakest of sorcery, but the son of Odin doth respond with force, the force of a thunder god. And the hammer goes sailing through the light and pops it like a balloon. And it's like you get some cool green Kirby crackle here as the hammer passes through it. And Baldur, I don't know if it's Baldur or Sif saying this. Thine hammer hath penetrated the shimmering light, thus dissolving the image of yon living talisman. Yes, thank you, Mort Weisiger. But the talisman is merely a warning. 'Tis the enchanters themselves who do pose the danger most deadly. And we see on a nearby rooftop, apparently, the other two enchanters, and they are Magnir, and he's the one who has these sort of little miniature goat horns on top of his head, so he's kind of the sheep guy. I'm going to call them the sheep guy and the lizard guy, just because, you know, it's kind of hard to describe them any other way. And the lizard guy is Brona. And so Brona has this sort of lizard helmet with the Viking-style horn sticking out the side. And Magnir is the one with little miniature sheep horns. And here, they actually, Kirby put little ears on his helmet, which I don't remember being there before. But again, you know, his costume is pretty much different in every panel. Yeah, they're kind of gloating over here. And they're saying, now that our talisman has located the prey, naught remains for us but to dispose of it.
Thy words possess the ring of truth, mystic Magnir. Once Thor hath been eternally crushed, not a sword in Asgard will dare be unsheathed against us. But see, the inconsequential humans do cluster about us, as uncomprehending as ever. Back, ye thou mesmerized mortals, back, do we say. And they're like shooting fire around themselves, and the people are going running, and yeah, you've got to wonder why they're bothering approaching them. So they create a ring of demon mist, apparently, is what Brona calls it. And then he says,
thus with a simple ring of demon mist, we do clear the area for the battle which is now to be. So speak the enchanters.
Prepare thyself, Brona. The god of thunder doth approach. And at his side, the loyal Baldur, and she whom Odin's son doth hold most dear.
How do they know that? Because, again, yeah, it's exposition, but they have no way of knowing this stuff.
Prepare to die, Asgardians.
Oh, it's Brona, incidentally, the lizard guy, who has the giant green penis. Just so you know. Which kind of makes sense in a way. And Thor and Baldur and Sif are approaching, and Thor is saying, if such be Odin's will, then so be it. Not even the specter of death shall stay our attack when evil threatens. And we then shift scenes to Asgard, where Odin is sitting on a very ornate and very confusing-looking throne. I guess it's a throne, but it also kind of looks like a wagon, but there's no wheels, so it's just kind of like this huge, overly elaborate chair. But it's a chair on top of a chair, because on top of this weird, elaborate frame of a chair is another throne, and Odin is sitting in that. So it's kind of very Jack Kirby-ish, and of course, like I said, we'll never see it again. And he's refereeing a wrestling contest in Asgard. And so there's these two half-naked men, and they're wrestling in front of Odin, and he's looking on approvingly.
Thy wrestling skills do much to impress thy sovereign lord. Therefore know ye both that Odin now proclaims, well done.
And some of the other gods are commenting on the match. Say, by the galaxies, 'tis a most fierce-fought match. Would that mighty Thor were here to test the victor's prowess.
The All-Highest hath mouthed the meaningful words, well done. Thus shall each combatant wear the proud mantle of Imperial Gladiator.
And then out of nowhere comes the strange figure, and it's a even more naked guy than the ones who appeared wrestling in the last panel. And he's this big, bald, giant guy, and he's wearing like red boxer trunks and looks like red sandals on his feet. And he's saying, make way for the power of the living talisman. And Odin looks very alarmed here. And he's saying,
the living talisman? None but thee would possess the effrontery to so intrude upon the pleasure of lordly Odin.
Yeah, I guess he likes to watch half-naked guys wrestling.
Speak then, arrogant one, and have thee done with it.
It doesn't give him any chance to reply. And the very next panel he says,
so, thou dost choose silence whilst daring to advance. Then let my scepter of power give tongue for both thee and me.
And he blasts him with his scepter.
and is consumed with like this yellow fire, and the various Asgardian gods are kind of moving out of the way because they don't want to get burned by this thing. Odin's saying, "For full well do I know that thou art no more than a face, existing within the mystic medallion worn upon thy master's chest. Thus let the evil image vanish, and by Odin's command let the true enchanter appear." And it does. It's actually Forsung, who is the armored knight guy in the blue and purple armor. And he says, "Behold, fearsome Forsung, eldest of the three enchanters. I have come to challenge thee for supremacy of all the fabled realm."
"What? Thou darest match thy powers against the omnipotent Odin?"
"Aye, in public assembly I do mouth the words. By imperial covenant thou canst not refuse." Now, that's not good grammar there. "I shall pit my power of supreme enchantment against thine, and the victor's prize shall be the all-powerful Odin sword, which doth repose within yon vault." Yeah, we've seen the Odin sword before. Remember, we had this whole Tales of Asgard story about it cracking that never got resolved.
"But know you, Forsung, when the Odin sword moves, it may well signal the end of the world."
"No matter. 'Twill be the end of thy world, not mine." And we then come back to Earth, and we see Thor and Sif and Baldur, and they're approaching the guy holding the big green penis. I need to explain that it's not literally a penis, like he's not carrying a giant dildo. It's actually this large, very phallic green bludgeon slash club thing, just in case anybody had any doubts. I really don't think that an actual penis would have passed the comics code in the 60s. And they're shouting, "For Asgard and the Realm Eternal!" The goat guy kind of waves his hands, and he causes a big chunk of the street to rise up, and it goes flying off into the air. And Sif and Baldur are left behind on the ground, but it's just Thor and the two enchanters on this hunk of rock that's kind of rising up above the city very, very quickly from the looks of it. And they're saying, "Now, whilst we rise among the topmost spire of yon mortal land, thou shalt meet thy fate. Ere this grim charade shall draw to a close, in all the universe there shall be Thunder God no more."
"Thor hath little patience for empty words. Have at ye both!"
And he goes after Magnir, and Magnir has a sword, which looks amazingly like the sword of Fry. and he strikes with a giant clang, and his hammer against sword, and Brona's are kind of in the background with his giant green penis, and he says, "Let the sword and hammer may strike to the death! Having been honed by my enchantment, the blade of Magnir can halt the thrust of thine own Uru hammer."
"Mayhap, but the arm of Magnir will never be the equal of the Thunder God's limbs. So saying again, I strike for Asgard!"
And he whips his hammer up and strikes him. But he has changed form. Magnir has changed into, it says a figure of pulsing energy, but it looks like he's changed into like some kind of weird glue. And or like the blob or something. It's really kind of hard to tell. Anyway, the hammer gets stuck in it, and Thor is trying to tug the hammer, can't get it out. And Magnir is saying, "Struggle as thou wilt, Thunder God. The game is ended. The victory won." And from behind, you have Brona coming up, which is a big mistake because he talked. "And now from the mace of Brona, thou shalt receive the final blow." Yeah, because you want to warn the guy you're sneaking up behind, right? And he strikes him from behind, and it is done. The Thunder God has fallen.
So too shall Asgard fall, never to rise again.
But Thor is not out, and by now this rock has floated up into space, and there's like Kirby Crackle and planets, and Kirby space is one of the coolest places, I have to say. I wish real space looked like that. But anyway, Brona's like,
"What unspeakable wonderment is this? The Asgardian still doth live.
'Twould need far more than a coward's blow most foul to slay the son of Odin."
"But thou dost begin to slip. Too near the edge thou hast fallen, making thee vulnerable to Brona once more."
And he's getting ready here to hit Thor with the giant green penis.
"And now prepare to depart forever, to take thy rest in the hallowed vale of thine own Valhalla."
And Thor is not giving up. He says, "I say thee nay, accursed one, not while such as thee do live."
"And I say perish."
But Thor manages to avoid his blow, and he's striking at Thor again and again with this giant phallic symbol, and it goes batam and fatoom. And Thor manages to grab Brona's ankle, and he hurls him off this rock, and he says,
"For thee, merciless Brona, thou shalt be no second time. The Thunder God has spoken."
And he pitches him away from the rock, and he's floating out there in space a little bit. And now Magnir's back in the fight. He says, "Thou hast fought the good fight, Asgardian, but in vain. Know you that we possess the power of self-levitation."
"Thou dost hold my Uru hammer, as though its power hath no effect upon thee."
"Still, I shall raise thee to thy feet, for thou art deserving of a second chance before we slay thee." And Magnir casts an enchantment on Thor's hammer, which causes the hammer to glow with the heat of a million suns. Apparently, the hammer is able to withstand this. Magnir hurls the hammer away from him, knowing that the hammer will return to Thor. Now, Thor may not be able to withstand this power of a million suns or whatever, so this is the point of suspense here. He hurls it away and he says, "A heat of none which Magnir can survive, a heat which not even the hand of Thor can hope to grasp. What say thee now, Prince of Asgard?" And Thor realizes he can't touch the hammer because it's too hot. And he reckons that sooner or later the hammer will strike him because it must follow him no matter what happens. And he realizes he has only seconds till the hammer turns. And so he goes up against Magnir hand to hand. And we see that Brona is kind of still floating out there in space, but getting there closer. Yeah, he's closer than he was. I guess he's making his way slowly back to the space rock. And Thor has managed to tackle Magnir, and he's holding him down. It looks like he's punching him in the face. And Bruno's like, "He hath leaped neath the flashing sword of Magnir, hurling my brother upon his back in one fell swoop." Again, thank you, Mr. Weisinger. "But though he battles like a whirlwind unleashed, though his strength be like a starburst unharnessed, still he faces enchanters too. Still the victory must be ours. Already the flaming hammer hurtles towards master, and when it strikes, 'twill be as though a million suns have caught him in their blazing fury."
And Thor reckons that because it was Magnir who enchanted the mallet, that if he disposes of Magnir, then the enchantment will be gone too, which is, it's kind of a, it's gutsy, I gotta say that. May not work, but anyway, so he's hammering on Magnir and really smacking him in the face and stuff. And just as the hammer is approaching and it's going to strike Thor from behind, he manages to knock Magnir out. And with Magnir unconscious, the enchantment does indeed fade away. And Thor is able to grab his hammer just in time to block the blow of Brona and his giant green penis. And so the two of them are fighting hand to hand, hammer against cock. Brona is saying,
"But still you forget, God of Thunder. The unplumbed powers of enchantment are ever mine to command, powers against which thou canst muster no defense."
And Thor is like, "Defense? What needs mighty Thor with mere defense? I do but strike, for..."
And Brona has changed into like a misty phantom, and Thor's kind of alarmed by that, and he can't actually strike at him in this form. But then he changes into the sort of black, billowy, adhesive smoke, like an oily smoke, I guess, and is surrounding Thor, and it's clinging to him, and he can't breathe. And Thor realizes that the cloud is Brona, and if Thor can reach Brona in time, then maybe he can defeat him. But we won't find out what happens right away, because we shift back to Asgard, where Odin is confronting the enchanter Forsung. The two of them are getting ready to fight, and Odin's like,
"Grasp thou the scepter of power, enchanter. Oh my, upon that side thy hand, upon this side mine. Through yon scepter our power will flow, smashing at the both of us, till only one hand doth remain, the strongest one of all.
And that shall be the hand of Forsung. Now, Lord of Asgard, in thy final moments, remove the powers of thy subjects, and I shall disclaim the use of my mystic talisman."
And the gods are telling Odin, don't trust this guy, because Forsung is a nasty character. And Forsung's like, I know not of tricks. I do but seek to engage in equal combat. And Odin is going to go ahead with this, because Odin is a fucking badass, and that's why I love him. Anyway, he's like,
"Be silent all, Odin hath no fear. The power of all Asgardians be now withdrawn. Naught but mine doth remain."
So I wonder what that means for Thor. But anyway, so the two of them are standing there, holding either side of Odin's scepter. And Forsung again, he says he's not going to use his talisman. And so the two of them begin to channel their power. And a big, huge fireball erupts from where they're standing. And it seems as though the very universe is exploding. And there's this huge fire consuming big chunks of of the city, and they go shooting off into space, and they're kind of careening through Kirby space, and it looks awesome. I have to say, this is a, you know, considering there's almost no characters on this page, it's a really cool page by Kirby here. And they're smashing asteroids, and they're flying around, and the Asgardian gods who are there, none of whom we recognize, are talking about how the battle will rage beyond all time and all space, far, far beyond the furthest range of thought itself. And when it doth end, shall regal Odin still hold reign? Or will the Lord of Asgard be him called Forsung the Enchanter? And meanwhile, back on Earth, we have Baldur and Sif, who were left behind when the rock went flying up into space. Sif, use your power and teleport us up to where Thor is. And Sif says, alas, loyal Baldur, I may not do so. What? Thou wouldst not aid him whom you do profess to love? I would, brave warrior. As Odin is my judge, I would. But my power hath mysteriously vanished. In truth, most faithful friend, I cannot. And it's funny that Baldur doesn't notice that his powers are gone too, because apparently he really just didn't have any back then. Or that was before he was Sunboy, like we saw in Baldur the Brave Mini. He's wondering if that the loss of power is the doing of the enchanters. And Sif is like, oh, and she hugs him. And he's thinking to himself that, he's, because he's holding her, that he has feelings that he dares not to possess, because Sif is Thor's beloved. So they're carrying forward this idea that Baldur has this unrequited crush on Sif. So we cut back to space, and Thor and the enchanters are on the asteroid still, and the mist is beginning to fade, but Thor is still alive, and Magnir's wondering why Brona has abandoned his attack, and it's because the pavement is descending down towards Earth again. I guess it's falling out of the sky. Thor figures out what's going on. He says, the figure of Brona doth return to normal, even as the section of pavement descends towards Earth once more. It's though thy powers have left thee both. Yeah. And Thor's like, strangely, you know, I do feel bereft of my own godly powers as well. So yes, what Odin did affected everybody. And apparently, Forsung kept his word. And Brona is the smart one and figures it out.
Then there can only one answer be. Odin and Forsung are fighting the ultimate battle. And both have renounced their powers until the end is come.
But if we have each lost our powers, then still we be equal in strength. Still I may strike for Asgard.
And the fight kind of starts again. And the rock carrying them, I guess, is setting down relatively softly, apparently, because Baldur is able to leap up on there and try to trip Magnir, for who's trying to strike at Thor from behind. And they're fighting on this rock, and Baldur saying, now that thou hast descended to Earth once more, the Thunder God no longer fights alone. So we have a piece of missed dialogue here, and we have Magnir addressing himself. He's like, Magnir, have thee at the brash intruder whilst I do finish before thine eyes. It's kind of hard to really tell who's saying what, but it looks to me like Magnir is addressing himself.
It's a pity thine actions cannot hope to match thy foolhardy words, enchanter, says Thor.
And we hear the sounds of battle, thapang, and whit, and Baldur's there fighting now. It says, enchantment thou may possess, evil Magnir, but thy skill in battle is no match for the Asgardian prowess of Baldur.
And Thor's like, brave one, to my side. We fight together as in days of yore, for Asgard.
And Brona's like, let him shout as he will. Cock of Brona, the mace of Brona, shall still prove victorious over the accursed hammer of Thor.
I say thee, never!
And they're pushing against each other by their weapons, but eventually the green penis, it breaks, and it goes limp, and Thor says, since we be without our special powers, 'tis strength against strength, and throughout the countless galaxies one truth is known. None have the power to match mighty Thor, and whilst breath remains in me, none ever shall. And he clocks him one real good, I guess, and knocks Brona out. So the two enchanters are defeated, and Baldur, Sif, and Thor are celebrating. Yay! And Sif is like, it is ended, my lord. The two enchanters are defeated. The victory is thine.
Nay, fair Sif, 'tis not so yet. Not whilst Forsung still doth live. Not whilst he battles Odin, even now.
But with Magnir and Brona thus bested, all we need to do is return to Asgard, and lend thy might to Odin's cause.
Alas, thy words are strangers to the deed. We are stranded here upon yon mortal world. And Baldur says, in truth, we cannot return to Asgard till our powers are returned to us. And should Forsung be triumphant, we've lost them forever. And as though it has just occurred to Thor that this is a possibility, he's like, Forsung? Triumphant? My brain cannot conceive so shattering a thought. And yet, my father now is aged and past his prime. I must return to Asgard. I must learn the awesome answer. And we have a next issue blurb next. Abandoned on Earth. So, yeah, it's a pretty much an all-fighting issue. So, as far as the actual story goes, it's kind of thin. But we do have some nice Jack Kirby art here. And even with the Vinnie Coletta inks, I think it looks pretty darn good. And especially any of the outer space stuff we see, with either the rock floating in space or Odin and Forsung flying through the air in space. I mean, all that stuff looks really, really cool. So it's a really nice art job here by Jack Kirby. Yeah, story, pretty good. I mean, again, it's an action issue, so there's really not a lot of plot there. All right, so we do have a Tales of Asgard backup. The title of the story is The Beginning of the End. And once again, our creative team here is Stan the Man Lee, Jack King Kirby, embellished by Vince Coletta, and lettered by Sam Rosen. And if you recall where we left off, we have Thor, Hogan, and Fandral. They're fighting against Satan's demon riders. I guess the 400, I forget what they're called. Anyway, it's these red guys, and they're dressed in this really ugly armor, and they're riding these bizarro horses. It's the only way I can really describe them, because they like bizarros, they look like they're kind of carved out of stone. And this one horse here looks really misshapen, and he has this like malformed jaw. It's like unhinged, like a snake jaw. And these horses have fangs, which is kind of a, you know, like vampire horses. It's kind of a nasty image here. And the three gods are fighting against them. And he's like, Hogan's like, back, thou scourge of Hades, though thy number be endless. 'Tis Asgardians who stand before thee. By sheer weight of numbers, they do seek to overwhelm us. Not even my enchanted mallet has room to swing with force supreme. And Fandral's like, 3 against 40, and still shall the triumph be ours. And we have a whole page here of fight, where we have Fandral is slashing at demons with a sword, and Hogan is smashing demons and horses with his mace, and Thor is, you know, they're trying to pin Thor to a wall using spears, but he's smashing them with his hammer and managing to dodge all the weapons. And then all of a sudden, an arm comes out with a sword in it, and it smashes some of the weapons that are threatening Thor. And Thor is like, by the matchless might of Mjolnir, a new ally stands with Thor. And this is actually Alibar, who, remember, we saw a couple of issues ago. And Thor is like, how art thou called, embattled one? I am Alibar, the vagabond. For daring to defy the rule of Mogul, he did place me at the head of the demon riders. But lead them I did not. Instead, I was by them pursued, for they slay anyone who lives. Such is the nature of Mogul's fiendish jest. But if perish I must, then let it be at the side of such as thee, Asgardian. Speak not of defeat, courageous one. Do we not still live? Yea, whilst one breath remains, let us strike for victory. Ah, if the voluminous Volstagg could be but with us now in this our time of trial. And they've managed to basically rout the Satan's evil horseman army, and they're falling back, and they're getting ready to charge again, but they failed the first time, and there's a lot fewer of them now, and Hogan is like, never before have Satan's horsemen failed the first attack, but never have they faced the likes of us. It matters not how oft they come, for they can never die, but what of us? Soon our limbs will be weary. But our hearts shall know no fear, says Thor, and Hogan is taking up the charge here, and he's saying, aye, though their attack doth last till hallowed Asgard is not but faded memory, still shall we stand, still shall we fight, and still shall we prevail. The very soul of Hogan can ne'er be at peace till Mogul has been crushed. And the rest of them say, so say we all. Now, my question here, so Alibar has now joined Thor and the Warriors Three as a temporary ally at least, but he's the one who had Hogan's battle standard. So where is it? And why isn't he just handing it to Hogan? You say, here's your battle standard. Anyway, just a thought there. So we then go back to Mogul. Remember, he had taken off on his flying skycraft thing, which he says that, legends will call a flying carpet. Remember that?
And he's flying over kind of a very nice landscape here. So he's streaking his way towards the sky, which is very odd because you thought he was still in the city with them. But apparently he's taking the scenic route to where they're fighting. And the mogul saying, "Now for my supreme feat of total villainy and vengeance. First I did conquer the land from whence came Hogun. But now I shall slay all who live. This simple jar contains enough powerful poison to spread the deadly spotted plague throughout all of Xanadu." Xanadu. Back on the ground below, you see Hogun's people who... Now, it's interesting because they're drawn here almost Mongolish, which is kind of one of Hogun's attributes. Is he kind of does have the sort of, you know, Russian warrior Mongol look about him. So some of Hogun's people are hanging out down below, and suddenly an unnatural chill doth fill the silent night. Aye, 'tis though the very stars themselves do herald our most certain doom. And then we cut back to where Thor and the Warriors 3 and Alibar are, and the Satan's cavalry people are heading for them again with their deafening, blood-curdling attack cry, which is, aye! Thor's like, "They come. So fight we now for Asgard!" And they all repeat, "For Asgard!" That happens a lot in this issue. And the evil villains, the army, they go, "For Satan!" Which is just too cheesy for words. But just as they're getting ready to attack Thor and company, they're dissolved in this giant green, like, weapon blast. And they evaporate as though they never existed. And the smoke clears, and Hogun says, "Thou?" And he turned around, and who should be standing there but Volstagg? Because remember last issue, he found the weapon in the dungeon, or in the harem, or wherever the hell he was. "Didst thou think the valorous Volstagg would abandon his fellow stalwarts? Whilst you were frolicking with yon riders, Volstagg did risk his precious life to seize this weapon from Mogul's arsenal. And now, invigorated by my cunning, inspired by my daring, thou mayst join thy hero for the final battle." And we have next issue's blurb, the end. So I guess they're going to wrap up the story next issue. And that is Thor number 144. So once again, what can you say about these 5-page tales of Asgard's? There's really not enough material there to really analyze, but, you know, it's progressing nicely. You know, it's a pretty good story there. And again, there's some silly elements to the story and things that they just kind of threw in that they clearly were just kind of making up as they went along, and they really weren't sure what to do. You know, you had this idea of the 40 Satan's horsemen or whatever. And they were rather easily defeated, even though they were supposed to be unstoppable. And even though they were ultimately defeated by Volstagg and this one weapon, it still seems like they should have been a little bit harder to kill than that. All right, so we are going a bit over time, so I just want to wrap up the show now. Thanks very much for listening once again. And of course, if you want to contact us, please feel free to do so. And the email address is radiofreeasgard@gmail.com. And thanks to everybody out there, including Scott and all the other people who are out there listening now. And thanks very much. I really do appreciate that. And we'd love to hear from you. So feel free to contact the show. Anyway, this is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois. We'll see you next week here on Radio Free Asgard.